May 2nd, 1981. Hope, British Columbia. After spending the night at a friend's house, 16-year-old Verna Bjerke leaves on a hitchhiking trip to visit her boyfriend, but never arrives. 5 months later, some of Verna's belongings are discovered in a remote area, but there is no trace of her body. A serial killer named Clifford Olson is soon charged and convicted for the murders of 11 children, which took place in British Columbia during this time period, and even though there is speculation that Verna was one of his victims, this is never conclusively proven, and she remains a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be traveling back to our podcast's home country of Canada to explore an unsolved missing persons case, the 1981 disappearance of Verna Bjerke. I received a request to cover this one from a listener named Madeline Shadeen, who happens to be related to Verna Bjerke through their grandparents. Back in September, I released an episode which focused on missing and murdered Indigenous women from Nunavut and the Northwest Territories, and discussed how one of Canada's biggest issues is their epidemic of violence against Indigenous victims and the lack of attention these stories often receive from law enforcement and the media. While you're not going to find Verna Bjerke's name on any lists of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, because she was mistakenly described as white on her missing persons report, and is still listed that way on the official website for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, aka the RCMP. But Madeline confirmed to me that this is inaccurate, as Verna's family are members of the Inkla Pamuk Nation, whose territory stretches from the southern interior of British Columbia to northern Washington State. When she was only 16 years old, Verna Bjerke went missing while attempting to hitchhike to see her boyfriend, and since some of her personal items would be found scattered in a remote area, it seemed likely that she crossed paths with the wrong person and became the victim of foul play. This was a particularly terrifying time period in British Columbia, as the Lower Mainland was experiencing an epidemic of murdered and missing children. A few months after Verna vanished, Clifford Olson, one of the worst serial killers that Canada has ever known, would be charged and convicted of a total of 11 murders, but there has always been suspicion that he may have had additional victims. In fact, while he was behind bars, Olson often liked to toy with the authorities by confessing to more murders and recanting these confessions, and while the idea of him being responsible for Verna's disappearance was definitely plausible, no conclusive evidence was ever found to implicate him. Verna's family came to believe that she was likely one of Olson's victims, but it sounds like some investigators were never entirely convinced, and since her body was never found, this is technically still an unsolved cold case. Tragically, Verna's mother and some of her sisters have since passed away, but Madeline requested that I cover Verna's story in order to keep her memory alive, as we still don't know for certain what happened to her. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Verna Bjerke. Our story begins in British Columbia in 1981, and our central figure is 16-year-old Verna Susan Bjerke, who is just 10 days shy of her 17th birthday. Verna lives with her mother, Claire Crane, and stepfather, Walter Crane, in the unincorporated community of Yale, which is located on the Fraser River. Verna is one of three children from Claire's previous marriage, as she has a 21-year-old sister named Irene, who has since moved out, and a 19-year-old brother named Dan, who is away attending basic training in Nova Scotia. Verna was actually conceived in Belgium because her father, Gordon Bjerke, was stationed there with the Royal Canadian Air Force, but the family would be transferred back to Canada before she was born. When Claire got remarried to Walter, she would have two more daughters, 12-year-old Gladys and 10-year-old Glennie, who both live with them alongside Verna in a home that is perched above Fraser Canyon on the Trans-Canada Highway. Verna is known for being a bit of a spitfire with a temper, but she's also described as being cheerful and likable, as well as a very talented artist and poet. Years earlier, she seemed to become resentful of the fact that her older sister and brother both moved out at young ages and got to experience the freedom of not having to worry about the rules of home and school. For this reason, Verna decided to drop out of high school and moved in with her sister Irene for a while. She helped take care of Irene's newborn baby while working a number of different jobs, but she eventually moved back in with her mother and stepfather and has made plans to take a commercial art course at Caribou College this coming fall. At the moment, she is currently employed as a waitress at The Godfather, a steak and pizza restaurant located in the municipality of Hope, about 25 kilometers south of Yale. Verna does not own a car, and often uses hitchhiking as her primary form of transportation to and from work. She also works the late shift, which would sometimes cause her to arrive home as late as 3 a.m., so in order to avoid waking up her family, she often spent the night in Hope with her best friend, Kathy Lamberton. Sure enough, after working her shift at The Godfather on Friday, May the 1st, Verna stayed over at Kathy's place, and she was planning to spend the rest of the weekend visiting her boyfriend, Hossam Solomon. Hossam lived in Kamloops, located over 200 kilometers northeast, and while Verna would have ordinarily made the trip on a Greyhound bus, the company happened to be on strike at the time. Verna assured her mother that she had arranged for a ride to Kamloops, but Claire advised her not to hitchhike if the ride fell through. Well, the ride did wind up falling through, but when Verna woke up on the morning of Saturday, May the 2nd, she told Kathy she was still planning to hitchhike to see her boyfriend, as she had already done so in the past. According to Kathy, she gave Verna a steak knife and told her to use it to defend herself if anything happened. Verna left Kathy's place at around 11 a.m., and witnesses would later recall seeing her walking out of Hope towards the Trans-Canada Highway while carrying a pair of roller skates she owned over her shoulder, but this turned out to be the last time she was confirmed to be alive. Verna was planning to return home at the end of the weekend, but her mother received a phone call from Hossam informing her that Verna never arrived in Kamloops. Claire then traveled to Kathy's house to see if Verna was there, but after learning that she already left on her trip and had not been seen since, Claire contacted the Upper Fraser Valley Detachment of the RCMP in order to report her daughter missing. Not surprisingly, the police were initially inclined to believe that Verna took off on her own and would eventually resurface, as she did have a prior history of running away from home. However, this did not make much sense to her family, as Verna was believed to have only been carrying $7, her roller skates, and a small handbag at the time she disappeared. Furthermore, she left behind additional money in her bank account and never picked up her last paycheck at work. On numerous occasions, Claire and her family would drive from Hope to Kamloops to search for Verna, and even performed one of these searches on Mother's Day, spending the day checking down every side road they could find. The citizens of Yale worked together to pledge money to a reward fund called the Find Verna Fund, and over the next few months, missing persons flyers for her would be distributed throughout British Columbia, Alberta, and even as far away as Alaska. Finally, on October the 19th, 5.5 months after Verna was last seen, some of her personal belongings were discovered in a remote area about 8 kilometers outside of Hope. At the time, the RCMP declined to publicly disclose what the items were or the exact location where they had been found. But decades later, it was revealed that someone had placed a rock inside Verna's purse and tossed it into the Fraser River near Highway 7. The purse wound up resurfacing when the water went down, and it was found under a natural gas pipeline which was suspended over the river. However, numerous searches of the surrounding area failed to turn up Verna's body. Even though the discovery of these items meant that Verna was likely the victim of foul play, Clara told the press that this offered a strange sort of relief, stating, quote, "At least it confirms what I've been saying all along, that something has happened because that just isn't Verna not to let us know where she is and what she's doing," end quote. Unfortunately, Verna was just one of many children to go missing or turn up murdered in the Lower Mainland region of British Columbia during this time period. Everything started when 12-year-old Christine Weller vanished from Surrey on November the 17th, 1980. On Christmas Day of that year, Christine's body was discovered over 30 kilometers away behind a dump along the Fraser River in Richmond. She had been strangled with a belt and stabbed in the chest and abdomen multiple times. While there would be no more crimes like this for the next 5 months, children would start being murdered or going missing with such frequency that there was fear that a serial killer might be operating in the area. On April the 16th, 1981, another girl from Surrey, 13-year-old Colleen Daigneault, disappeared after she was last seen at a bus stop in North Delta. The next victim, 16-year-old Darren Johnsrud, ordinarily lived in Saskatchewan with his father, but had traveled to Coquitlam to visit his mother. On April the 22nd, just 6 days after Colleen went missing, Darren also disappeared after he was last seen at a shopping mall drugstore. 2 weeks later, on May the 2nd, his body was discovered at the bottom of a rocky embankment in the unincorporated community of DeRoche, and he had been bludgeoned to death with repeated blows to the head with a hammer. In an eerie turn of events, Darren was found on the exact same day Verna went missing. The next victim was 16-year-old Sandra Wolfsteiner, who lived in Langley, and disappeared while hitchhiking on May the 19th, as she was last seen climbing into a car being driven by an unidentified man. On June the 21st, 13-year-old Ada Court, who lived in Burnaby, vanished without a trace after she was last seen on a bus. Things really escalated in July, when a total of 6 children became victims within the same calendar month. On July the 2nd, 9-year-old Simon Partington disappeared while on his way to visit a friend in Surrey, and only 1 week later, on July the 9th, 14-year-old Judy Cosmo went missing from New Westminster. Judy's badly decomposed body was found in a wooded area near the community of Agassiz 16 days later, and she had been stabbed 19 times. On July the 23rd, 15-year-old Raymond King Jr. vanished after leaving his home in New Westminster to look for a summer job. 13 days later, Raymond's decomposed body was also found in a wooded area near Agassiz, only about a kilometer and a half from where Judy Cosma had been discovered. The next victim was Sigrid Arndt, an 18-year-old German exchange student who was last seen in Coquitlam on July the 25th. And 2 days later, on July the 27th, 15-year-old Terry Lynn Carson went missing after leaving her family's home in Surrey. The month's final victim would be 17-year-old Louise Chartrand, who left her residence in Maple Ridge to hitchhike to her job, but never arrived. Well, on August the 12th, the RCMP finally picked up a suspect named Clifford Olson, a 41-year-old construction worker from Coquitlam who had an extensive criminal history and already spent a good chunk of his adult life in prison. By this point, Olson had already popped up on the radar as a potential suspect and was placed under surveillance. He wound up being pulled over and arrested for impaired driving after he picked up 2 young female hitchhikers on Vancouver Island near Port Alberni. Olson had an address book in his possession which had the name of one of the victims, Judy Cosma, in it, and 6 days after his arrest, he would be charged with Judy's murder. However, while investigators suspected that Olson was responsible for many of the other child murders and disappearances which had taken place, they weren't sure if they had enough evidence to prove it, and at this point, the only victims who had been found were Christine Weller, Darren Johnsrud, Judy Cosma, and Raymond King Jr. Olson had a wife and an infant son, and believe it or not, the wedding had taken place on May the 15th of that year, only 4 days before Sandra Wolfsteiner went missing. In what would become one of the most controversial decisions in the history of Canadian law enforcement, Olson made a deal with the RCMP, in which he agreed to make a full confession to all of his crimes, in exchange for a substantial amount of money being placed into a trust fund for his wife and son. The arrangement was that Olson would be paid $30,000 to offer up evidence that he was responsible for the murders of the four victims who had been found, and paid $10,000 for the bodies of each additional victim that he provided to the police. In total, Olson's wife and son would receive $100,000, and when this deal was finalized, Olson led the authorities to the remains of Colleen Daigneau, Sandra Wolfsteiner, Ada Court, Simon Partington, Sigrund Arndt, Terry Lynn Carson, and Louise Chartrand. Olson was subsequently charged with a total of 11 murders, and in January of 1982, he pled guilty to all these crimes and received 11 consecutive life sentences. He was transferred across the country to serve out his sentences at the Kingston Penitentiary in Kingston, Ontario. Olson would go down as one of the worst serial killers in the history of Canada and earn the nickname the Beast of British Columbia. And not surprisingly, there has always been speculation that Olson may have had additional victims. Since Verna just happened to go missing in the Lower Mainland region during the same time period when Olson was committing his other murders, it seemed very plausible that he could have been responsible for her disappearance. However, while making his deal with the RCMP, Olson never attempted to lead them to Verna's remains or confess to her murder. In late August of 1981, after the discovery of some of Olson's other victims, the RCMP held a press conference to discuss his possible connection to unsolved missing children's cases from the area. Superintendent Bruce Northrup confirmed that Verna had been removed from the list of missing children believed to be Olson victims, stating, quote, "I'd said at an earlier media briefing that I wasn't satisfied all the missing persons cases were connected, and I had in mind for sure Simon Partington and Verna Bjerke. And all I can say now is that we have no reason or evidence to believe the disappearance of Verna Bjerke is connected to the others," end quote. However, this statement came as a surprise to Verna's family, who said that the RCMP never provided them with an explanation for why they reached this conclusion. Indeed, after Olson entered his guilty plea 5 months later, Crown Prosecutor John Hall publicly expressed his belief that Verna was likely an additional victim. Investigators did confirm that Olson had not been eliminated as a suspect and would continue to question him about Verna's disappearance while he was behind bars. Even though the RCMP had tried to keep their $100,000 payment to Olson a secret from the public, their arrangement with him eventually leaked out to the media. There was a tremendous backlash to this news, so the authorities made it clear that even if Olson had committed additional murders, they were not going to offer him any further financial compensation to confess or provide information. In November of 1982, the RCMP agreed to take Olson out of the Kingston Penitentiary and bring him back to British Columbia in order to assist them with their investigations into some unsolved cold cases from the province, including Verna's disappearance. There was hope that Olson might lead the authorities to the remains of additional victims, but after they arrived in BC, he apparently did nothing but procrastinate and waste time, so investigators came to the conclusion that Olson was leading them on a wild goose chase and was not going to offer anything useful. In spite of this, Verna's family have always believed that she was one of Olson's victims. In 1996, Verna's sister Irene decided to write Olson a letter in prison to ask him if he murdered Verna, and she even offered to send him aerial photographs so he could pinpoint the area where Verna's remains might be. Olson responded by maintaining that he did not kill Verna, but claimed to know the identity of the person who did kill her, writing, quote, "Yes, I know who it was, and yes, he is still out there, and yes, they will pick him up soon," end quote. Verna's former best friend, Kathy Lamberton, also wrote Olson in prison to ask him questions about Verna's case, and while he never actually admitted to murdering Verna, he still made such cryptic statements as, quote-unquote, "she did not suffer." He also confirmed that Verna had the steak knife Kathy had given her for protection on the day she vanished, but said that it wasn't used to kill her. Kathy shared these details about her correspondence with Olson in an article which was published in the April 24, 1997 edition of the Hope Standard, and it contained another surprising story. Kathy claimed that Olson had actually picked up her and Verna hitchhiking together on April the 30th, 1981, 2 days before Verna went missing. Even though Olson dropped them off without harming them, Kathy said that he was weird and gave them a bad feeling, and when Olson was arrested months later, she instantly recognized his photograph in the newspaper. However, 2 weeks after this article was published, the Hope Standard published a rebuttal letter they had received from Irene, who questioned Kathy's story about her hitchhiking trip with Olson and alleged that Kathy liked to make statements with shock value. Irene said it was never conclusively established that Verna had this prior encounter with Olson, writing, quote, "This is something Kathy thinks she remembers, but we have no evidence of this event and no way of proving it," end quote. Even though Olson had received 11 consecutive life sentences, the Canadian Criminal Code once had a statutory provision known as the Faint Hope Clause, which allowed prisoners to apply for early parole after serving 15 years, even if they had already been sentenced to life imprisonment. In 1997, Olson did attempt to seek judicial review for possible early parole, though no one actually believed he would receive it and walk out of prison. But at one point during this process, Olson tried to deny the court access to his psychiatric records and made this statement to the presiding judge, quote, "I would under no condition return any unsolved bodies in Canada, which I am presently doing now, my lord. I would just cut it off completely, and there would be no more bodies being returned for a proper Christian burial," end quote. Indeed, once it became apparent that Olson was not going to be paroled, he started claiming that he was responsible for many more unsolved murders than he had ever been charged with, going so far as to say that he had killed over 100 victims in both Canada and the United States. But of course, Olson would often recant these confessions and change his stories, so he was never conclusively linked to any other murders besides the 11 he had been charged with. In 2002, a poet and author named Gwyn Hunt, who also happened to be a friend of Irene Bjerke, wrote and released a one-act play called Missing, which explored Verna's disappearance and was intended as a tribute to her. The play essentially used Verna's story to explore the issue of missing women and society's apathetic response to them, and was also heavily inspired by the lack of compassion shown towards the victims of Robert Picton, another notorious serial killer from British Columbia who preyed on sex workers. When the play was performed, images of real-life missing women would be projected onto a screen below the left-hand side of the stage. Actresses portrayed Claire and Irene during the production, which concluded with an actress playing Verna delivering a monologue about her disappearance. On May the 12th, 2011, a memorial service was held for Verna at a church in Yale, and it was attended by over 100 friends and family members. This date was only 10 days removed from the 30th anniversary of Verna's disappearance, and was chosen because it would have been Verna's 47th birthday. The service was held because Verna's loved ones never had the opportunity to give her a proper funeral, and they would lay flowers on a family plot at Yale Pioneer Cemetery. Sadly, the family had experienced another tragedy in May of 1989, when Verna's youngest sister, Glennie, was killed in a motorcycle accident at the age of 18, but Glennie and Verna would have matching pink gravestones resting beside each other at the family plot. During the service, Verna's brother Dan shared a line which I'm sure you've heard before in true crime circles when he said, quote, "Verna's smile lit up a room." 5 months after the memorial service, on September the 30th, Clifford Olson died of terminal cancer at the age of 71, but no conclusive evidence was ever found to implicate him in Verna's disappearance. And unfortunately, Verna's mother Claire and her older sister Irene have also since passed away without receiving any answers about what happened to her. Over the years, Verna's family has performed a number of searches for her remains, but they have never been able to find her, so she continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro, I received a request to cover this case from one of Verna Bjerke's relatives, Madeline Shadeen, who wants to get Verna's story out there. The Trail Went Cold is definitely not a podcast that likes to focus on famous serial killers, but I'm always interested in exploring the stories of missing and murdered persons who may have been unconfirmed victims of said killers. Clifford Olson's story has already been extensively covered by true crime podcasts and true crime media in general, and while I have no desire to give evil psychopaths like him any more attention, that can sometimes be necessary if it will bring more attention to unsolved cold cases. Even though many of these other forms of media who have covered Olson's story do try to pay tribute to his known victims, very few of them have ever mentioned Verna Bjerke, and regardless of whether she was one of his victims or not, her name definitely deserves to be remembered. Madeline first got in touch with me near the end of 2022, and while I didn't originally plan things this way, I felt it made sense to do an episode about Verna's story shortly after I released my two-part anniversary episode about the 11 who went to heaven. You can make a number of parallels between these two stories, as the 11 who went to heaven was an expression used by convicted murderer Edward Harold Bell to describe 11 teenage girls who were murdered in Texas during the 1970s, as Bell decided to take credit for all these unsolved crimes years after he was sent to prison. Ironically enough, even though it's never been proven that Bell killed those 11 girls, we do know that Clifford Olson had at least 11 victims, since that was the number of murders he confessed to before he was charged, convicted, and sent to prison. But of course, Olson's story did not end there, as over the next three decades, he would claim that he was responsible for additional murders. Much like Edward Harold Bell, Olson often liked to change his stories and recant any confessions he made, so you couldn't be certain if he was actually telling the truth about anything, or just getting off on toying with everyone for attention. And in the end, Bell and Olson were never conclusively linked with these additional crimes before they passed away. Even though I grew up in Canada, I would have been less than 3 years old when Olson's crimes made the news, so I have no memory of them. But the whole story was a pretty big deal, and anyone who grew up in British Columbia during the early 1980s will tell you that it was a pretty terrifying time. To recap, Olson murdered at least 11 victims between November of 1980 and July of 1981, which is a span of only 8 months. Verna went missing in May of 1981, so on the surface, it might seem like quite a coincidence if Olson was not the perpetrator and Verna wound up being harmed by a completely different killer who has never been identified. Verna's family have always said that they pretty much came to terms with the fact that she was likely murdered by Olson. Regardless, they still wanted to recover her remains and give her a proper burial under her gravestone in the family plot, but Olson never came clean and revealed the truth before he died. However, we have that statement which RCMP Superintendent Bruce Northrup made in August of 1981 about how investigators do not believe that Verna's disappearance was connected to Olson's other murders. They never really provided much clarification about why they said that, but at the time, the RCMP was making its controversial deal to pay money to Olson's wife and son in exchange for him leading them to the remains of his victims. Perhaps they initially felt that Verna's case was unconnected to Olson because he never confessed to killing her. But as the years have gone on, we now know that Olson was such a manipulative person that we can't take it on good faith that he was being truthful about all the crimes he committed. At the very least, the RCMP did not close Verna's case or rule out Olson as a suspect, but they never turned up any conclusive evidence to prove or disprove the idea that he was the perpetrator. So like I mentioned in the intro, virtually all the sources out there mistakenly list Verna as being Caucasian, so even though she's actually a member of the Inklapamuk Nation, you won't see her name on any lists for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. I only bring this topic up because of another famous true crime story from British Columbia, and that's the Highway of Tears murders. The Highway of Tears is a phrase used to describe a 725-kilometer corridor of Highway 16 between Prince George and Prince Rupert, where a few dozen young women and girls have been murdered since 1970. We don't know the exact amount of victims who have been killed within that corridor, but a disproportionately high number of them are Indigenous. Now, Clifford Olson's murders, as well as Verna's disappearance, took place hundreds of kilometers south of Highway 16, so there's no reason to believe that Verna's case has any connection to the Highway of Tears murders. However, during the late 1980s, a serial killer named Edward Dennis Isaac was charged and convicted of the murders of three victims which took place on the Highway of Tears: 36-year-old Jean Mary Kovacs, 13-year-old Roswitha Fuchsbichler, and 15-year-old Nina Marie Joseph. These crimes all took place between October of 1981 and August of 1982, which means that there were other serial killers operating in British Columbia during that time period besides Clifford Olson. Now, regardless of whether or not Verna was an Olson victim, I guess the upside of being associated with such an infamous serial killer was that she was going to get a lot of media coverage by default. Even though Verna's name is not widely known on a national scale, she was mentioned in a number of articles about Olson's crimes, particularly in British Columbia. In fact, if you do a search on Verna Bjerke's name at newspapers.com, you'll actually find a photograph of her from when she was only 6 years old, as she was featured in an article from the May 12, 1971 edition of the Hope Standard for participating in the annual Yale Walk to raise money for junior forest wardens. Even though Verna was only on this earth for just under 17 years and had dropped out of high school, she seemed to do a lot during her short lifetime and came across as a very active, independent, and adventurous person. I made this exact same statement during my recent series about the 11 who went to heaven, but one of the most eye-opening things about researching this story is seeing how freely Verna, as well as many of Olson's other victims, were hitchhiking at such young ages. But like I've reiterated on this podcast many times whenever I've covered older cold cases, it was just a much different time back then, and cases like these are what helped people become aware of the dangers of hitchhiking. In fact, after Verna went missing, her mother, Claire, even made some statements in the Hope Standard advising others not to hitchhike. Now, to be fair, Claire had specifically asked Verna not to hitchhike to go visit her boyfriend in Kamloops, but the only reason she did so is because there was a Greyhound bus strike at the time, and another ride Verna had arranged fell through. If either of these events had not taken place, Verna may never have gone missing. It seems obvious that Verna wound up hitching a ride with the wrong person, and given that her personal belongings were found only 8 kilometers outside of Hope, she was likely harmed a short time after she left her friend Kathy Lamberton's place. And given how Clifford Olson picked up many of his known victims while they were hitchhiking, it's entirely plausible that Verna came to harm after accepting a ride from him. But one controversial element of this case is Kathy's claim that both she and Verna had previously hitched a ride with Olson 2 days beforehand. Verna's family have always been very skeptical about this story, and even if Kathy is telling the truth, it's possible they may have been picked up by an entirely different creepy guy, and Kathy later mistook this person for Olson after she saw his photo in the paper. Indeed, if Verna already had an unsettling experience hitchhiking with Olson, why would she have agreed to climb into a vehicle with him again 2 days later? If Olson was responsible for Verna's disappearance, then geographically, it would have taken him a lot further east than his other known crimes. Olson lived in Coquitlam, which is about 135 kilometers west of Hope, and he abducted most of his victims from the same region. But on the other hand, he would sometimes travel great distances to dispose of their bodies. For instance, the remains of Ada Court, Judy Cosma, and Raymond King Jr. were all found in a wooded area near Weaver Lake in the community of Agassiz, which is just over 30 kilometers away from Hope and quite a distance from where he lived. This seems to indicate that Olson would travel out of his way if necessary. I have read vague reports that Olson could be placed in the Hope area around the time Verna went missing, as he apparently cashed a check of one of his victims at a bank in Hope and sought treatment for a scratch on his leg from a local doctor. If this information is accurate, then I can definitely believe that Olson crossed paths with Verna while she was hitchhiking, and she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's easy to assume that Verna's remains might be in the same general area where her belongings turned up, but multiple searches turned up nothing. Of course, these items were not discovered, until 5 months after Verna went missing, so even if her body had been left out in the open, it's possible her skeletal remains could have been scattered around by animals, making them more difficult to recover. During the early stages of the investigation, the authorities did not disclose any specific details about Verna's personal belongings or the exact spot they were found, in hopes that withholding that information might help weed out false confessions. Indeed, I'm obviously not privy to everything that Olson said about this case over the years, but if he mentioned anything about Verna's disappearance which was not already public knowledge, then this would lend a lot of credence to the idea that he was the perpetrator. So obviously, the most controversial part of this whole saga was Olson's deal with the RCMP to confess to all of his murders and lead them to the remains of all of his victims in exchange for $100,000 being placed in a trust fund for his wife and son. I get why the RCMP decided to do this, because there had been an epidemic of missing and murdered children in the area, and they were under tremendous pressure to close these cases, but even though they were certain that Olson was the guy, they just weren't sure they had the evidence to prove it. But the whole situation set a dangerous precedent and left a bad taste in many people's mouths, because even though Olson's wife and son were innocent victims in this whole affair, they wound up receiving a lot of money they otherwise would not have gotten had he not murdered 11 people. Needless to say, something like this would never happen today. But the big unanswered question is, if Olson was responsible for killing Verna, why not confess to the crime and lead the authorities to her remains in order to potentially receive additional money? Well, the issue is that by complying with Olson's demands for a financial payout in exchange for his cooperation, the RCMP were giving him a lot of control and power. Following the backlash to the situation, the authorities confirmed that they were not going to offer Olson any more deals or provide him with additional financial compensation. But had this not occurred, for all we know, Olson may have decided to use his knowledge of Verna's whereabouts as leverage to benefit himself while he was behind bars. In fact, I previously mentioned that in November of 1982, Olson led the RCMP on a wild goose chase by promising to help them find the remains of additional victims. When Olson was convicted of the murders, he was hoping he would be incarcerated inside a prison in British Columbia, but he wound up being sent to the Kingston Penitentiary in Ontario, which was pretty much Canada's go-to facility at that time for housing the worst of the worst. So I think that Olson just wanted an excuse for the RCMP to take him on a cross-country trip back home, which is why he fed them false promises about helping them close more cold cases. One of these cases was Verna's disappearance, but even if Olson did kill her, he may have intentionally decided not to lead the authorities to her remains so he could still have something to hold over everyone. Indeed, Olson definitely does not fit the profile of someone who would plead guilty to their crimes and then just sit quietly in prison for the rest of his life, as people in his position will often do anything they can to ensure they remain the center of attention. Over the years, some of Olson's claims got progressively more bizarre. In addition to claiming that he was responsible for over 100 murders, Olson once said that he had useful information about the Green River Killer from Washington State, even though his murders did not even start until July of 1982, after Olson was already behind bars. And at one point, Olson actually claimed to have inside knowledge about 9/11, but did not offer up an explanation for how a guy who had been incarcerated for 2 decades prior to that event could possibly know anything about it. But while you can easily dismiss most of Olson's outlandish claims, the problem is that you just can't simply do that with Verna's case, since it is possible he could have been responsible for her disappearance. Olson did not hesitate to play mind games with Verna's family and friends, because even though he wouldn't admit to killing Verna himself, he claimed to know who did do it, and made such odd statements as, quote, "she did not suffer." Well, if he had nothing to do with Verna's death, then how could he know she didn't suffer? The fact of the matter is that narcissistic individuals like Olson have no reason to tell the full truth about anything unless there's something in it for them. There's always a bittersweet feeling when evil people like him die, because even though the world is a better place without them, it's frustrating to think that they could have taken secrets about missing and murdered victims to their grave and intentionally deprived their families from receiving any sort of resolution. Overall, I do find it most likely that Clifford Olson was Verna Bjerke's killer, but there's no way to be 100% certain. If by chance, Verna was murdered by another individual who disposed of her body, it's possible that they just got incredibly lucky that a serial killer wound up getting arrested and dominating the headlines later that same year, which allowed the real perpetrator to remain under the radar and get away with it. But that scenario is all just speculation, because other than Clifford Olson, no one else has ever been named as a suspect or person of interest in this case. It's very sad that Verna's mother and two of her sisters passed away before they could recover her remains and receive conclusive answers about what happened. But since they believe that Olson was Verna's killer, I suppose they took some comfort in knowing that he would remain locked up for the rest of his life. In all cases involving serial killers, I believe that instead of remembering them, we should remember the names of their victims. And in this particular story, we know they were Christine Weller, Colleen Daigneau, Darren Johnsrud, Sandra Wolfsteiner, Simon Partington, Judy Cosma, Raymond King Jr., Sigrid Arndt, Terry Lynn Craven, and Louise Chartrand. And regardless of whether or not she was Clifford Olson's 12th victim, we should always remember the name Verna Bjerke, because she was a bright young girl who had her entire future stolen away from her, and her loved ones would still like to bring her home. So another special thanks to Madeline Shadeen for bringing Verna's story to my attention and helping keep her memory alive. If you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Verna Bjerke, please contact the Upper Fraser Valley Detachment of the RCMP at 604-792-4611. That's 604-792-4611. Or you can also call Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a top 10 list-themed bonus episode where I count down the top 10 surprising twists on Unsolved Mysteries. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1994 murders of Michael Johnston and Rochelle Robinson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. Of course, later this year, The Trail Went Cold will be in attendance at two separate CrimeCon events. The first one is CrimeCon UK, which is returning to London and will be held at the Tower Bridge Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa on June the 10th and 11th. And 2 months after that, I'll be attending the regular CrimeCon event, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, and this time around, the same code is valid for both events. So in order to purchase tickets and get a 10% discount, you can either visit crimecon.co.uk or crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLE23. That's COLE23. And if that wasn't enough, I will also be in attendance at this year's True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. For more information about that event, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶